Welcome to The Ramp Up, the podcast that tells inspiring stories of the thought leaders, founders, and experts behind the leveraged loan and structured credit markets. I'm your host and CEO of Auctora, Brian DeGila. And together, we'll uncover what it takes to ramp up your market, turn the tide, and really shake things up. How do you migrate an idea into a thriving business? Let's find out. Today's guest is Hans Christensen, co-founder, CEO, and Chief Investment Officer of MJX Asset Management. Hans's seemingly typical career journey turned out to be anything but. Beginning as a credit analyst at Harris Bank with a hand calculator and a slide rule, Hans has witnessed the evolution of the credit industry, spending a good chunk of his career at Citi before moving to Barclays and eventually spinning the business out into MJX, which currently manages over $17 billion across multiple CLO funds. Hans has built an incredible business and counts himself lucky to be surrounded by a team of smart, highly experienced people who have stuck around for the journey. But how did Hans, the credit guy, get to where he is today? Listen to our fascinating conversation and find out. Hans, welcome to The Ramp Up. Very much appreciate you making time for us today.
My pleasure.
So let's get into it. A place I like to start is from the beginning. So tell us a little bit about growing up. I know you're a Midwest boy, so let's talk about a little bit about what that was like.
That's fortunately very unremarkable. Raised outside Fort Wayne, Indiana, in a fairly rural environment. In eighth grade, the family moved to Anderson, Indiana. So yes, Hans Christensen did live in Anderson. And then finished my high school actually in a suburb of Chicago, Elgin High School. Attended Elgin Community College and then transferred to Indiana University's Fort Wayne campus to go back to where I'd grown up.
How do you get into the professional world? Where did you start?
Well, I was fortunate to get a job in the credit department of Harris Trust in Chicago. And I really did feel I was very fortunate at that time. The mid-70s was not always easy to get a job. And it was very different. I'll start with that. Have to remember the hand calculator wasn't invented until 71. When I started my job, I had a calculator, but I was one of a few. But I also used a slide rule.
What year was that when you started at Harris Bank?
76.
76. I'd also know that when you were at Harris Bank, you enrolled in night school for your MBA.
I did. And that was after I decided, since everyone was enrolling in their MBA, I wanted to be a little different and focus on my weakness. I felt my undergraduate in finance didn't need an MBA per se, already felt I knew most of it, and chose to pursue a law degree, which unfortunately the bank did not reimburse. And 3 years in, I quickly realized that I was not really going to cut out for law. And so 3 years of night school, law school, then I shifted and got my MBA at DePaul. But it was a wonderful experience. Again, you're starting out before most of the technology existed. Hand calculators were new. I remember when we got, 3 months after I started, we got a 10-key calculator put on our desk, the plug-in, so you could add, subtract, multiply, and divide, because otherwise you were hand-checking everything. And when you wrote things, everything was longhand. You handed it into a typing pool, got it back, proofed it. Fully typed, written, a five-page memo would have been very long because, again, everything was handwritten. It's funny, some of the things you remember during that period of time, everyone had touchtone phones. And when you got a hand calculator, maybe you don't notice this, but numbers on a touchtone phone, which all of us became very proficient at because that was the only way you communicated that, and internal mail put in envelopes. It would usually take a day or two for a response. So you would call, and the numbers go 1, 2, 3 across the top. Yep. The hand calculator starts at 7, 8, 9 across the top. Yes. And the number of errors I made when I tried to use a hand calculator initially were not insignificant. And I developed In my case, a technique, I dialed with my left hand and did the calculations with my right hand.
Interesting. Wow.
Strange, but that's what I do. And to some degree, I still do that. I'm very, very fast with a 9-key calculator with my right hand, not so much with my left.
That's incredible. And I imagine back then, spreadsheets were still actually sheets of paper.
Oh, yeah. 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 You had to check everything when you got everything back from the typing pool. You checked it. And it had to be reviewed. And I had one of my supervisors, she was wonderful, wicked smart. And when she had the hand calculator, she would try and check some of the numbers and had maybe some of the same problem I had. She was an abacus.
Wow.
Wicked fast.
An abacus.
It was faster than, I did a slide rule for multiplication division. But yeah, the abacus was great. Photocopies was only a Xerox machine. It did about, I'll make it up, 10 pages, probably 20 pages a minute. So if you're making five copies of something, made five copies, you had to sort, everything was manually collated, hand stapled.
Yeah.
So none of the technology that we had today. And it wasn't that long ago.
No, it's not. It's not. This is a span of 40, 50 years. So,
yeah,
Harris Bank. What comes next?
When I did get my MBA, I wanted a bigger platform. I wanted to get into marketing and felt I was being held back at Harris. So I had an opportunity to join Bankers Trust Company Chicago office in their credit department. They'd started a new one. I was replacing someone, I believe. You know, that was at a time that I joined Bankers Trust. They still had branches run by Al Britton, and they were in the transition period of trying to become what they referred to as a merchant bank. And that was quite a transition. I started again initially just doing credit memos and a couple of things that were a little interesting during that transition was the effort to make the bankers better at talking about corporate finance. They knew about making bank loans. And you have to think back. At that time, virtually all companies were investment grade or they borrowed from banks. The non-investment grade world, I think 1980, 81, I remember some of this research, there was under $2 billion of high yield debt.
Well, over $1.5 trillion today. So that's incredible change.
And again, everything was hard copy. There was nothing electronic.
Mm-hmm.
You were either on the mailing list and got the hard information. You spread it yourself going back to the comment of everything was spread by hand. Or conversely, you would go to every bank had a little research library that they would have some of the original data or else they would store it on microfiche. And so you're looking at these little things and printing it out in what was then thermal paper. So if you left it in the sunlight, it turned black. And so you'd be somewhat careful about the daylight. Vampire problem. And as I met the people at BT that were doing this, they had access to a computer. With the finance companies, a little different. And finance companies at the time were 50% or more commercial paper. And a guy named Alan Wheat had joined BT and was talking about this thing called interest rate swaps. And since I felt that one of the challenges the finance companies had was locking in financing because commercial paper could dry up. There had been times where it had dried up, and I thought, well, if you fund with a bond and do an interest rate swap, and spent a lot of time, like many people at the time, educating. And that was probably the only time that my 3 years of night school in law paid off because I could read the contracts and understand what they were doing.
I was going to say, you did do 3 years. I hope today it helps with indentures and things like that.
My one thing I did discover was when they think you're going to law school, they think you want to be a lawyer. I didn't want to be a lawyer. I just didn't want to – I just felt I needed to fill in the holes as a banker. And so they started having me read loan documents, and that was – I said, I got to go back and get an MBA because then they'll treat me like the person I want to be, which is just a credit guy. It was enlightening to understand that you could separate funding from interest rate. Also, you're trying to understand what the risk profile was.
Yeah.
You're agreeing that over the next 5 years, somebody's going to pay an interest differential. And that was new. You had to come up with a mechanism. A few months later, Citibank Minneapolis called and said, do you want to come up and interview? So I moved to City Minneapolis. The name of mine had to be Scandinavia again.
So now you're in Indianapolis with City, my alma mater. Yeah. What were you doing for City?
I moved over as a relationship manager covering Upper Midwest. And there were a couple of things that came out of that. Although I was – I covered names in out of Chicago for BT, it was across the Midwest. There were three or four names that were overlap that I'd covered at BT and was suggested I could cover at Citibank. And the thing I remember most was first the effort at BT, very good bank, great reputation, innovative, that often it was very hard for me to get them to call back. The first day, I called each of them and said I'd move to Citibank. They called back. And I realized maybe it wasn't me, the jerk, that they couldn't call back. Maybe it's the seat I'm in. Worked hard at that. And then I think 84, 85, somewhere in there, Citi went through one of many reorganizations. And they wanted to become more competitive in the corporate finance advisory work. That people saw that Glass-Steagall was going to break down. They wanted to be able to talk about bonds. Again, some of the things that BT had already I'd already experienced some of BT. And they wanted a few people to – they wanted to create a new group, an analytical group to support the RMs of against these big companies that were big relationships at Citibank. And it was – again, we have to go back. High yield almost didn't exist. If you were a big relationship with a big bank, you were investment grade, substantially all. You were doing things at a global level you were doing. If you did bank loans, and many of these companies still did bank loans even if they're investment grade, it was a tight spread. And so we after my experience at BT and the effort that I saw that type of analytical support could do, I raised my hand and said I would happily participate in that. It was a new venture. Very few people wanted to do it because you're removing yourself from the money-making business. You're creating basically an – people thought is if you're not in the front line, you're at risk for a lot of reasons.
But I think that's a – to just put a pin in that, I think that's an important characteristics of successful entrepreneurs, which is sometimes – you got to go to the barren land. You got to go where, you know, it's uncharted. And it's not always comfortable to your point, right? That's not where the money is being made. But that's where the opportunity might be because, again, it's a new space that you're getting into.
Yeah, exactly. I went, I don't know, 3 months. They moved me to New York for 3 months and then asked me to relocate from Minneapolis to Chicago to build what was the Midwest team. And it was interesting. It was mostly staffed with undergraduates, you know, the two-year analysts, and a couple of seniors. I was one of the few seniors, and we really worked to develop ways we could come up with to be thoughtful advisors to the relationship managers at these companies. One great thing for me was I was one of the few that had actually used PCs and new to this little spreadsheet thing called Lotus 1-2-3. And so I was, as time went on, I realized as we were working on transactions that most people working on transactions would have a junior person out of school working on the numbers. And I was a little more advanced. I had over 10 years of credit experience by then. And I was doing my own model, so I could sign off on my own models. Gave some benefit, and you know, as the bank was doing that, centralizing, of course, that was the beginning of the what became the leverage buyout period. And so I was initially working with many of the big bank clients, you know, to fend off raiders. I did work on some leverage transactions, actually a lot of leverage transactions. That became substantially all I did for about 4 years. Working some on Wall Street with the Wall Street team as well as the Midwest team on if there was a company that was getting attacked, You know, that would be, it was almost always a Citibank customer, or Citibank was on the other side trying to take them over, one or the other. Learned a lot. You were trying to develop valuations. You were trying to develop new ways of doing things. You also saw something that, again, you I know at some of the senior levels, probably Citi saw it and other banks saw it. But again, we were transitioning from something that had a credit process that was predominantly investment grade across the industry to a growing high yield business. And coming up with ways of it was growing so fast because you went from zero to huge very, very quickly, grappling with that transition, grappling with what, how do you change your credit culture, because not everyone could do it. So fewer people were – they were trying to make fewer people able to sign off on some credits. But it went on, and then 89, things changed a little bit. I had the opportunity to stay in Cincinnati for an extended period of time, working on the Federated bankruptcy, helped on the restructure of USG. And then, of course, what, October, November of 89, UAL blew up, and kind of the lights went off. And a lot of banks, and especially Citi, which was a leader in that at that period of time, was wearing a lot of debt, a lot of non-investment grade debt and suffering. And again, the way things were put into that portfolio, just it was just a big portfolio, and they didn't know everything that was there other than what was suggested and recommended.
Is that when they put you to New York at that point?
Well, yes. There were the – no, I don't think there was any surprise. It was pretty well known. The feds started asking a lot of questions at Citi. And they needed to standardize what the portfolio risk profile was. It was a capital issue, and it was decided that they needed an independent group that would assign risk profiles for all these non-investment grade credits. And they were working with several senior people. And at that same time, there was a group of analytical there was an analytical team, outstanding group, that was developing a lot of models, including a debt rating model. Mm-hmm. That we had used during, you know, sort of the late 80s, we were using it, but all models can be manipulated. So they decided we have to make it a little more independent. And since I was both on the analyst pool side, as well as, you know, pretty, I guess, fairly sophisticated in the analytical work, my joke was I was the only credit person that didn't take a step backwards when they were asking for volunteers. Mm-hmm. Again, the original goal, the original assignment was, here are all the companies, start putting the numbers in and pop out what the rating is. Yeah. So we can analyze, so we can just have a standard metric. And I had a couple of challenges as a somewhat thoughtful credit person. You can't just put numbers into a model and know what the risk profile is. Yeah. I suggested that it's better if we take if we actually do a credit review of each credit and run it, and it'll be independent. We will not will be independent from the relationship team. But I wanted to do the credit memo. But to do that, I wasn't going to do the traditional credit memo because it was usually used as a training ground where you'd have a 30 and 40 page credit memo about here's the auto industry. It's, you know, Henry Ford started this company, and it would be, you know, just a history thesis. Yeah. And then I needed to get analysts. Since they were laying off people, I knew that there were some high quality people that might be available. And I went from to financial control, to credit admin, to various groups, and ask them, do you have a high-quality person that you know will leave, has the opportunity to leave the bank in this environment that you think is important for the bank? Yeah. I did it, and that's how I built the team. I did it for a couple of reasons. First, you are trying to do something good. Yeah. And I'd worked with a lot of people that were outside the credit world and knew they were smart, wanted to get into credit. That's where you want to go. But as importantly, these tended to be people that were, you know, say, you know, late 20s, maybe early 30s, but you tend to be late 20s, already had a network, already had credibility within the departments. and had a network. And I felt that if I'm doing something that's different, I wanted to have credibility with the various departments as well. So if you're taking their financial controller, the department head already knows the person. You're taking their credit, their senior credit admin, they already know the person, know the person's dependable, knows the culture, knows how to do things. So as we built the team, and I didn't have a lot, I think we ended up with 12 or 15 initially, I was able to send them through the three-month credit program. Outstanding group. And we continued to do that as the group continued to grow. We also, when you're doing that, you start seeing all the inefficiencies. Banks are required to review a credit every year. And if a company was, if the first credit approval was October 13th, 1921, I promise you, October 13th, 1991, you were still doing that damn credit memo a year later. And because many of the departments were grouped by industry, and frankly, as you were looking across the portfolio, everything was grouped by industry, I thought, let's do an industry at a time. And that actually, when I presented it, got approval to try one.
With all the other industries.
Industry-wide across North America.
So they would take it for granted, but that makes sense.
Everything was, you were changing things. And then began implementing that. The group got bigger again because suddenly.
How big are we talking about at this point?
I don't remember. As we started doing that they started reintegrating the credit process into the corporate finance process. So it suddenly exploded. I think at one time somebody suggested it was maybe 200 people. Well, it was a whole North American credit. I don't know. And probably for that reason, they suggested I move to the portfolio side.
That's a lot of people in a bank, right?
It's a big bank, and they had a lot of analysts. Yeah. It was corporate finance, it was credit, it was everything. Yeah. So, and it covered, again, all of North America. So you had a lot of people. A lot of them were senior, so it wasn't that hard, and everybody managed through. And they pulled me out of that to suggest, let's start using all these great tools that the bank has built because we need third-party investors. There were a few loan funds, but there was the asset class of bank loans was all banks. And they said, let's prove it. So they gave me initially a couple $100 million and say, start using all the tools. Some of the tools included, some of them were very interesting. In addition to defaults and trying to come up with ratings, the optionality in bank loans. Because bank loans, they trade off of, if you say it's a double B minus, okay, what's the like a bond?
Yes.
Is it rich, cheap, double B minus? Within the bank loan as well, there were commonly at that time, which it happened now, there were triggers to go up or down in spread. So if a company got upgraded, the spread went down. If the company got downgraded, the spread went up. We had mechanisms to try and capture that as well. So you're using these models to try and determine rich, cheap, trying to determine obviously the risk profile. They put me in a room probably smaller than this, and as many windows too, and gave me a gateway computer, a Bloomberg screen, and a Sun Microsystem Spark 2 to do all some of the quant stuff, and a staff of 10 figures, and I started buying.
Wow. So this is the beginning of, I'm going to call it the loan proprietary trading desk at Citi.
Well, you needed to be invisible. I did everything through Calder.
John Calder.
Yeah. A trading desk. The main trader I worked with was Marjorie Harris, and it was great.
John was still there when I sat at Citi.
Yeah, so he was there a long time. And we did a lot of, it was doing it. as that was going on, the industry reviews and some of the new credit paradigms that were being used within the bank, they started identifying exceptions. There was a standard that a certain risk profile, you couldn't have a bigger exposure than this. That was part of the way they were going to manage capital. Again, this is a bank that was capital constrained by then. And any issuer that was outside the limit, they wanted either to sell in the cash market if they could. And there was also this little new thing that they had come up with that had presentations on called credit-driven default. You could buy default protection. And asked me to help coordinate that. So I was basically a traffic cop. Somebody would say, hey, we need to reduce some of this. I would work with cash and over time the derivatives desk. Again, you had to be invisible. So it was always on the bank's desks. So it looked like they were just trading, not a principal.
So behind the market makers for the bank.
Always.
You had
to be invisible.
JP or Chemical Bank, I imagine they were some of the largest dealers in CDS swaps back then.
And shortly after that, I got a call on something that turned out to be, I didn't know it at the time, but I learned very quickly, from a Canadian bank. Their October 31st year end wanted us to provide protection for a big portfolio for 3 days. What is this about? It was over their year end, and it was explained that they could remove it from the balance sheet. Very innovative. I thought it was a brilliant idea. So I went through that. A couple of odd things about that was it turned out as we were exchanging phone calls, phone numbers in the event we needed to talk to each other over a weekend because it was a quick turnaround. Yeah. Turned out it was my neighbor across the street. And he now works as part of MJX.
Wow.
But there's a lot of that aside. So then they started, once it was unbundled, explained, went through a lot of process. I was asked to start doing that to help the bank.
And this is now hedging the bank's loan book, not just.
Yeah, I was already doing some of that on a nips and tucks with individual names, a few hundred million here, by various credit protection name by name. But suddenly it was, could you do portfolio trades so you could do over year end capital trades? That apparently turned into a very big business. It was quickly removed to me, to someone that specialized in it because it had changed so much. Some of the things you have to look through. The first time we did, the first credit derivatives we did, you had to go through and with a simple question, what happens if there is a default? What do I deliver? And my staff expanded to double. I needed a credit admin to go through and see if we could actually deliver the loan. If they have bonds, of course, you always wanted to deliver bonds. But anyway, they shifted that off, and I then continued to then invest only in the banks, in this little proprietary portfolio, and as a spokesperson to make it an asset class. In the year 1992, 93, or 93, 94, one of those days. And Citibank's asset management asked if I would like to come over and start managing third-party money instead of the principal money. And I actually debated that. We had $300 billion of high-yield stuff that I understood. I knew how to manage, or the macro stuff manage. And somewhat reluctant, but I decided, let's give it a shot. And so I moved over there to start a business. And the first person I called was one of the analysts that had worked with me when we were doing the centralized credit process, Marty Davey. He'd moved over to the high yield research, became a high yield trader. And I asked him if he would like to join. I promised, we'll eventually trade high yield. Never did. And he after more than a little bit of talking, he did agree. And then we started building the rest of the team. I had this small portfolio from Citibank that was going to be unwound. We got a We launched a low-leveraged market value fund called Eclipse. We started managing an SIV, this loan SIV, and we also had a managed account, an SMA, $3.5 billion, $4 billion by 99.
Loan fund, $3 billion. That's a big number for
at that time. I was given the opportunity to move to Barclays, so put it nicely, and the opportunity came partly because a couple of the people that I'd worked with at Citi that had helped develop some of the portfolio management technology had moved to Barclays. And
of course, knew what you brought to the table.
And they had a CLO business under David Forbes Dixon, now called Alcentra, that they'd grown and had been fairly successful. They wanted to start a U.S. business. So in 2001, put the team together. I pulled five others from the Citibank team. Marty, obviously, who's the co-founder of MJX, Mike Regan, who's retired, Christine Tang, who is also retired, and then Maria Cruz, who unfortunately, while we were there, was murdered. But that was the team that we brought over and started launching the business at Barclays. I brought in Ken Osman, and then Atha Ba was the other person we brought in, and Atha had worked on the Citi trading desk as an analyst, and I knew him well. He moved around to DLJ and Credit Suisse. So people that I'd already known, and we started building the team from there.
You at Barclays, you have launched a couple of venture transactions.
We did Venture 1 and Venture 2, and then they wanted to get out of the CLO business, very capital intensive for a bank. And we initially had discussions, would we go as one group, the U.S. versus European? And since we were so new, we would just be eaten alive. As well, they're just different businesses, European business and the U.S. business. We thought we could separate. He already had some they already had some strong interest on the European side, and we would just be a throw-in to get rid of us. And so Bob approached us and said, why don't I buy you?
This was a Darwinian moment for our market. Remember, with so many CDOs, all kinds of three-letter acronyms, for the most part, only one survived. Mm-hmm. And that is the CLO business where you are. But Hans, when I remember that period, the couple of things that stand out to me around your franchise MJX. The first is how much active you guys were in your portfolios. Because I remember looking at your equity, particularly as we came out on the other side, and you guys were trading so much that created so much value to the whole transaction, not just the equity, but to everybody in the capital structure. That was the first point. Second point was I saw you guys do things that people were not doing. You got in the liquidation business. You were doing all kinds of stuff. What was it like running a business in those 3 years for you?
I cannot say enough how important it was to have a wonderful team. When it hit, we all saw this was a real problem. And we also knew, to some degree, we couldn't abandon our investors. We also wanted to keep everybody on board. This was not we'd been through a few downturns before. Certainly, I mentioned I moved to New York in the 90s during a downturn. I saw layoffs. I saw a lot of challenges. And when you have a good team and a good culture, you want to keep it in place. So everybody stepped up. Our operations team found some people that could outsource and charge a small fee for. You mentioned we had one of our team players, Dave Harrington, knew a lot of people in the ABS market. That's where his background was. And we were able to start liquidating CDOs, derivatives. There were a lot of the CDOs. I mean, billions and billions of dollars of CDOs we liquidated, and some of the liquidations, I'm fairly confident our fee was represented the majority of the total value that was created. We had contacts at a large bank that had been investing in basically the AAA, AA type of CLO paper that was – they had to move to the – from available to sale to mark-to-market portfolio and had let go the entire team. And we negotiated an agreement that we would provide quarterly reviews of every position in the portfolio, including underlying credits for that portfolio for a fee. It was strangely partly because of our liquidation and other contacts. As part of the Merrill Lynch being acquired by B of A, we acquired a Merrill Lynch subsidiary that could not go under the B of A umbrella. As part of do we make much money? No, but you're counting pennies. Everyone suffered. Everyone participated. Related to the credit team, we were looking for, we talked about all kinds of things. Something that we have done actually since the inception of the company, and this goes back to, frankly, the Citibank experience of doing sector reviews. We chose quarterly sector reviews, and we had always recorded them and made them available to our investor. The skill set we had, we brought in a lot of experienced people that included a lot of people with high yield experience as well. So we had high yield, we had credit, we had a lot of people that understood, were involved, and also the sophistication of understanding how the CLO works. Again, you could build par that fast.
Not everybody was doing it, though. It took a lot of guts to make those calls. You had to have a strong, great – and as you speak about your team, it's a very fundamental credit-driven. So you had to have strong views about those names.
You've been in the industry a long time. Have you ever met a credit person that doesn't have a strong view and thinks they have a great underwriting process? We all do. We're all good at credit or we wouldn't be here.
But when
97% of the time throwing darts through a cycle, we're going to be right. So the difference is not the is how much of the 3% are you off? And we work very hard on that. It's always about, it's that. Some of the innovations, some of the ideas, the way we would trade. We also, this goes back to the starting of our company. I should go back to it, and you commented about the amount we trade. When we were building the company, the experience we had at Citibank caused us to realize the asset class is illiquid. Even today, in good times, of course, it's, you can trade, but who wants to trade a 101? But in bad times, the market freezes very quickly. $2 and $3 million trades can freeze the market or drop 5 points. And with that in mind, we had experienced when we had chunkier positions that you couldn't get out of names. And again, in the 90s, it sort of didn't matter. It was called the par market because if something went below 98, it just didn't trade anyway. But when we started building the company, we decided we are going to be an active manager. To be an active manager, we have to have small positions, so we have to build the whole company around that process of being a diversified manager.
That's why you're on high discount deals. That makes sense.
We want smaller positions. So when 2008, 2009 especially hit, we had smaller positions. We had the capability of trading, and we wanted to do something. We were not going to just stay and watch. The CLO market, the benefit of CLO is time has typically been your friend. Most companies will repay a par, 97% on average through a credit cycle. But you can always look to improve. So we were constantly looking for those types of opportunities, and by only trading $500,000 or $1 million, you could do that. I'm not trying to move $5 million. I'm not trying to move big positions. I'm trying to take small positions, and you take what the market gives you. Through 2000, 8 and 9, we did that. We built a lot of goodwill. Certainly, we built a lot of par. We built we had good performance through that. But also because of our communication, mm-hmm. our transparency to our investors, we continued to go out. We continued to travel to Japan. We went to various other places. When the market reopened, our investors asked us, why aren't we launching? And we said, well, you know, we don't have capital backer. We rely on goodwill, frankly, the goodwill of our investor. And very quickly, one of our investors said, well, I'll put up the capital. Let's raise it. We went. That was Venture 10. Mm-hmm. And 6 weeks after we closed it, the same AAA investor called back and says, can we do that again? Wow. So,
by the way, in between this period, and mm-hmm. I don't know if you want to talk about this, when you left Barclays, you left, I think it said Bob Silliman
had yes.
financed that exit. And I know that sometime around the crisis, you yep. guys...
We bought him out in 2008.
2008.
Yeah, when all this was going on, 2008, 9, maybe to 2009. He was looking to exit a lot of his positions. And we... it was... That was not an easy decision. So, I mean, you wanted to do it, but the price was dear.
Yeah. In hindsight, right, I'm sure it was a great transaction.
I will honestly say, Marty and I were highly leveraged professionally,
yeah.
Personally and professionally. We, you know, our lives, our liberty, and our children.
What was the conversation at home?
No problem. If I'm going to bet on anybody, it was right. myself and my team.
There you go.
We knew what we were doing. That maybe sounds a little foolish and arrogant, but this is a group of professionals that understood what we were trying to accomplish. And as I commented, when you have operations people figuring out ways to make money, when you have fund compliance people trying to figure out how to do things, when you see the entire – when you're entering new businesses that you never did as a consultant – there was no stone we weren't going to unturn. With that entire approach, yeah, everyone was – the entire team was fighting to keep the paycheck and the company going. And when you have – what do we have? 35 people at the time. You have 35 people pulling that sled, it's comparatively easy. Yeah, you're the leader. You're the one with the biggest financial risk. But professionally, you did. I did not feel that pressure. It was an incredible experience. So when you say, and people disagree, it was a remarkable experience for everyone on the team, anybody that went through it, anyone whose firm survived and right. it ultimately did well. You know what the experience was. One of the, it really matters.
It does.
So I was. You know, so did I think it was a lot of risk? I professionally, on behalf of institutions, I think I've taken more risk.
Fair enough. Well said. So, Hans, you were clearly out of the woods at 2012. You've done two more deals then. And look, I do, obviously, we had a remarkable rally and growth, you know, as we get into CLO 2.0 days. I want to fast forward to MJX today, but before we do that, I just want to pivot and acknowledge the other part that makes you great, which is you have an active life outside of the world of CLO investment. I know there are two organizations that are important to you, if we can talk a little bit about that. The first one is A New Beginning. Tell us about that organization and how got involved.
Sure. I was marketing in the Middle East 2005, I believe, and what was a then friend had a nephew who was killed in a firefight in northern Pakistan and was having a memorial service in northern Pakistan. He was with the Frontier Police or Force, which is sort of this like an army in the region. That's definitely Taliban country. And when we went there, I asked a simple question. It's part of this. So you separate. And so I'm only with the men. And I asked a simple question, and I phrased it, what can one man do to help? And the response was, help us educate our women. All of these individuals had wives and daughters that had been well-educated. Virtually all of them had attended British schools, including Sandhurst. And they appreciated the need to continue to have that type of culture within the infrastructure, despite, they were blowing up, they were blowing up schools. Certainly there had been attacks. And initially made an effort to try and do something in the north, and that was, we could not get anyone to help because, I'm going back to the U.S. Yeah. I don't take risk. So we were able to look through what were referred to as ghost schools in Lahore, Pakistan, and found one that we chose to adopt and began with, it was about 50 students. And if you're familiar with ghost schools, it's where the teacher shows up, two or three times a week, not a lot of great education. We brought in teachers. We were teaching them English. The school grew very quickly to over 200, so we had to put up army tents to facilitate because it was a one-room schoolhouse. Actually, one of the things that was interesting when we were investigating what are the things we need to do to prepare for this was investigating what they did in South Africa after apartheid. And as they were building girls' schools and African schools for the blacks, first thing they did, especially with the girls' schools, was a bathroom. And as it happened, that was a bathroom and running water were the first two things we installed. Very quickly, again, it got to 200, and over time, we were asked to take over the boys' school as well. And then the government, the success was such that the government decided to take the two one-room schools and then all the various army tents we had and build a very large school. I think they're eight-room school, two-story. And then in their own way, we got pushed out a little bit. So we continue to support, but they really run the show. We also did some work with particularly young women and widows to teach sewing and hairdressing and things so they could learn to survive, keep them off the street. We continue to do some of that. It's been very important.
The other organization, Hans, that I wanted to talk to you about is the Army War College Foundation. Tell us about that one as well.
When I was a very good friend of mine, I mentioned scouting. Peter Lanchinus had active duty 30 years, or he was an attorney, but was a reservist the last part of his career. Was a graduate of the Army War College, was on the board at the time, and they were in need of someone with some finance background. That the foundation board is made up of half graduates and half civilians. It's by design. Its focus is to support the U.S. Army War College and what they refer to as the margin of excellence. The U.S. government does not provide all the things that you need to do for, to educate future military leaders. And it's an effort to do things, paying for higher, we've been able to support chairs. We've been able to support various alumni meetings and a variety of other things. So they brought me in initially on the finance side. And after you're limited to 2 3-year stints, and you have to rotate off. And I completed my second 3-year stint, and COVID hit, so we had to vote. We couldn't bring anybody in or out too easily.
You were stuck.
So I ended up, they extended for 2 years, mm-hmm. and then subsequently I've been made vice chair. What's interesting about the Army War College, and I'll go through it a little bit, it's called Army War College. There's also a Naval War College in Rhode Island. There's the Air Force War College in Colorado Springs. It was founded under Teddy Roosevelt by Elijah Woods with a motto, not to promote war, but to preserve peace through strength and wisdom. Its intent is to provide thoughtful ways for senior leaders to get there. All of the men and women that attend have been in at least 20 years. And as the entire time I've been there, our country's been at war. Yeah. So all of these people have been at war virtually their entire career. And this is to provide what is truly this, you know, the senior leaders that will go to the Joint Chiefs to provide ways of thinking differently rather than the tactical, but the strategic. It really does try to teach parts of the strategic aspects. If you go through, you can go online. The people that graduate there are incredible. It is the who's who of military leaders in our country.
Also, I know there's international alumni because
they started in the 70s bringing in international, what are referred to as international fellows. They are nominated by their country, by their country's military, to attend the U.S. Army War College. And it's about 80 students. That's when you called me. I was in Zambia, Lusaka. That was an unusual call to find out you grew up 200 miles away. since we never met, I thought that was unusual. And with that, since they are nominated by their country, it's military, they're typically identified as that in Sandhurst. They're identified as people that they're grooming for future senior leadership. In the past 18 months, 13 of the international fellows have been promoted to the highest rank in their military. It's unbelievable. When we were in Zambia, they just the most recent head of the Zambian Army is a graduate, and he was gracious enough to come in and talk about it, and talk about the benefits of what it offers that you don't think about. Yeah. When I was there again, just before COVID, and then they've continued on since, working with the international fellows to continue education. You do it in the U.S., but outside the U.S., having these alumni continue to have classes about military strategy and economic strategy for military leaders and future leaders is very valuable. Yeah. And while he was there, there were 13 countries represented. He went up and started talking to the leader from Nigeria, and commented that the power of what the War College brings comes through with things like me knowing him. He said we were not classmates, but we were assigned on a UN peacekeeping mission. Mm-hmm. And he said, when you're assigned to UN peacekeeping mission, it's a cacophony of different countries that come together. I knew he had the same education I did. We spoke the same language. And the trust and confidence of us working together was critical for the situation we were in. If I knew I could trust him and his view and his leadership, and he knew he could trust me in the way we communicated. He said the importance of that type of communication is incredible. I'm very blessed to be part of it. So you asked a little bit about that part of it. But the MJX thing is much more fun. I mean, well, in its own way. It's what I do for a living. It's what I do for a living. But it's great. It's a blast.
To do this for 40 years. Let's go back to that.
Thank you. Thank you for keeping me young. But okay.
You have to be passionate about it. I feel the same about my business. Mm-hmm. What does MJX look like today, Hans?
Well, certainly the market continues to change. We're if you don't adapt, you die. I mean, it's very Darwinian. I love that. Makes it a little harder. Mm-hmm. Because we are exclusively third party equity. It makes it a little harder to control some of the things that are going on. When we see opportunities, we have to talk someone else into it. Other than that, it's pretty much the same. It's a little – the competition for fundraising has changed because increasingly I do see the big money goes toward the asset class rather than alpha.
Hans, if you could go back and do it all again, what would you do differently?
You know, I like that God only lets time go in one direction. That when you're, as a result, you have to persistently learn. If we go back and try and do things, you know, you can't.
Yeah.
So we're actually blessed in that. And along the way, I have had wonderful advice from family, from friends, from coworkers, mm-hmm. from managers. And like everyone, I talk to myself. I give myself advice all the time. I don't always follow it any more than I follow other people's advice because that's discipline. And, yeah. You know, you have to have discipline to follow your own advice. Yes, I'm going to lose weight this year.
Yeah.
it's not a big deal. But along the way, you become more refined.
Yeah.
You also see the impact of decisions you make. As a parent,
yeah.
as a spouse, as a business manager, as a manager, as a coworker, you see the impact of some of your decisions, both for our investors, for ourselves, and it gives you a richness in your future decisions that I think is very critical. As you start identifying the impact that, and we have all made decisions. I know I certainly have made decisions that hurt people, and at the time, did I appreciate how much I was hurting them? No, probably not. Or would I have made the decision the same or differently? I don't know. But I can't go back and change it. What importantly it does do is it makes the next time I make those types of decisions, I reflect for the second and third and fourth order of impact of those decisions. And I think that's what makes for, you know, a rich person. You start seeing the broader impact mm-hmm. of what you're doing as you're building your own business. You've been through some of these before. You've worked for a large organization. You see the things that you don't want in your organization. I don't want this type of bureaucracy. I don't want this type of situation. So you try and avoid it. And you find the consequence of the positive and the negative. There are things you say, maybe I do better understand why they had that discipline involved. Conversely, so maybe I should institute the thing that I really said I never wanted to do. Or conversely, you know, in retrospect, I kept that because that was what I grew up with. Doesn't make any sense. Get rid of it. Those are the types of things that make you a better person. I think it makes for a richer life. And so to go back and say, what would I do differently? Can't do it. So it doesn't really matter, you know.
Well said, Hans. I appreciate your time. I have one more for you. So as you look at our market, a lot of change, a lot of evolution. Some things are new technology, but some things are the same. We're still doing credit analysis. When you look at the future of the CLO market, what does that look like to you? And what are the opportunities for this for us participants in this space?
I do think about that some. Actually, just you know, over the holidays, I started thinking a little bit about it. It continues to be dynamic, just as we had, you know, what's referred to as 1.0, 2.0. I think we're at 3.0 or so. You know, they have to make something up. Certainly, the dynamics of the things like LME, the dynamics of faster changes that can go on. The potential risk of some of the recovery rates that could have an impact. it's going to continue to be dynamic. I think that some of the models that we use for ratings are likely to have to adjust to that because – and I don't know if they're – it'll be interesting how far back they start going because they may try and – instead of going back a long time, they may have to truncate the data sets that they're using. Yeah. You know, they – 900 CLOs out there now. A lot of them are older, but you're going to start seeing some of that. I do think with the proximity, I'll go back to a type of transaction we had, we called Vista. That was around the time that we did Venture Force, so was that 2004, 2005. Mm-hmm. Jerry DeVito set it up. It had market value triggers. And I could see that something like that returning because of the importance of MBOC, the double B. You have the leverage of a Basel II bank, for God's sake. The difference is we only have seven, you know, we only have 3 years, 5 years, 7 years to reinvest. Banks continue to, and the banks also retain rather than pay out big dividends. They don't pay out 100%. They pay out a smaller amount so they can continue to build because over time, you know, we've done deals where you've done a couple of resets. I mean, you're burning up the equity and that's in – a bank doesn't do that, or at least a well-managed bank doesn't do that. So I think that some of that will has the opportunity to evolve. If someone's going to try it, can you actually do it? Perhaps with ETFs, you'll be able to find the AAA to do it, and you can work your way down the stack. We'll see if other investors do it. Will there be an equity investor to do it? Absolutely. I think some will be perpetual. I think it's possible to do, for lack of a better term, a CLO that's perpetual, which is a bank. Yep. Why not? since 2001, so what the heck?
You know what? With the continuous
we'll 25 years later, we'll see.
Hans, you've been very generous with your time. Thank you for coming on the podcast again. I very much enjoyed the conversation.
Thanks for listening today. For more conversations like this, subscribe to The Ramp Up wherever you listen to your podcasts. See you next time.